podcast, we're going to talk about electrical as part of the series of test cell design.
Looking forward to it. Where do we start? The high voltage or?
Yeah, I think we should break it down into two parts, okay. You know, low voltage and high voltage, because there's a lot of aspects that we need to cover in both of them, and then how they intertwine together. One affects the other, obviously.
Okay, let's dig into the high voltage first then.
Okay, so if you look at high voltage, when you're designing a test cell, you're going to look at all the equipment that's going to be put in the test cell. You need to design with that in mind. So in our area of work right now, it's dynamometers. And typically, if you're running an AC dynamometer or utilizing an AC dynamometer, that's going to be the large consumer of power in the test cell. And it brings its own challenges associated with that.
So just to calibrate them, what sort of levels of voltage and current are we talking about for a big AC?
Well, you're going to be looking at three-phase power.
Yeah.
And it all depends on the size of the AC motor. Right. But to put things in perspective, when you're putting electrical into a single test cell, it's typically more power than what a house utilizes in totality.
Right, yeah. If you're looking at a dyno absorbing, you know, 500 kilowatts, that's a big AC motor. It's a big motor, so it's going to take a lot of power to it's going to generate a lot of electrical power.
Yeah, in fact, if you look at the households in the United States, the services have gone up. So if you're looking at, typically you'll see a 200-amp service in most modern homes. That barely even covers just the test cell outside of excluding the AC dynamometer. So then you're adding to it on top of that. So just to get perspective, it's a lot of power.
Right. So looking at the power for the actual dyno for an AC, there'd be some power absorption for an eddy current also, but I guess a water break would be on the lower end of the electrical requirements, even though it's got its water input.
It would. But when you think of the perspective of what goes into utilizing high power, right? So we briefly touched on the dyno, right? The AC dynamometer,
right,
but all
right.
Three types of dynamometers take power or utilize power. You've got your facility controls. What that means is you've got, say, your ventilation system. So you have to keep that room cool. Those are driven by fans, and they require power. Those require controls. So that's another aspect of power design inside a test cell. And that's just from a high power perspective, let alone all the lighting, let alone the receptacles for additional auxiliary power. Those are all part of the equation when you start looking at this.
But the big power users that are going to be considered in the early part of the design, presumably, is the coolant flow to make sure you've got enough power to drive the coolant round.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to typically cool the air as well and have air handling in general. So we've got some big fans to bring air in and take exhaust and air out again.
Right. And then you've got, that's just the air ventilation part of it. Then you've got your cooling systems, your liquid cooling.
Mm-hmm.
So depending upon the size of your cooling system, you may have a cooling tower with a series of pumps, depending on how many test cells you have. That's a large drain on power that you need to be considering when you're putting in a test cell. That's part of the equation as well, even though it's spread across maybe multiple test cells.
Okay. So those are the big building blocks, if you like. But then we've got to move on to both the normal accessories in a test cell, the electrical power for those, and then the special requirements of instrumentation.
Yeah, one other thing I'd like to bring up, and I know we didn't talk about this as we led up to the outline of this podcast, but we got to talk about electrification because that's another large consumer of power when you think about it. So if you're doing battery testing, and you're having to charge the battery and discharge the batteries, representing whatever vehicle that you're testing, there are devices that are utilized that consume quite a bit of power, and it's the part that actually charges the battery very rapidly that consumes a large power too. So in today's world, if you're into the electrification aspect of it, you'll have to consider those things too, depending upon what your test cell is going to do.
Yeah, good point, because I think we started off really discussing more conventional engines, fuel-burning engines, rather than electrical power units. So that's
right.
A good point. And
right.
A fast charging system, which you would need to drive some of those, obviously consumes a lot of energy as well.
Yeah, so at a company we once worked at together, I had to put together three test cells that had this similar scenario that I'm explaining. And it was, in some circumstances, larger power consumption than the dynamometer itself.
Yeah, an interesting aspect of dealing with that higher power is as well as the electrical requirement, actually the physical requirement of wiring in some of these pieces, because you're looking at some extremely heavy cabling to absorb, but to cope with these power levels.
Yeah. And again, that's a topic that we did talk about in the outline when we formed this podcast together. And just the logistics of routing, let alone the expense, obviously, with the size of cables we're talking about that have to run through conduits that are extremely large, and bend radiuses are a concern, and they take up quite a bit of space. So all those are factors in considering not just what you need, but how the heck do you route these things in and out of the test cell to wherever they need to go.
Yeah, important to lay it all out, first of all, and just see how this is going to sit in the room. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know if we want to jump to the other aspect of the power, which is the grounding, or keep going down the path of talk about the signal side of things now. What do you think?
I think the signaling side, I think the grounding will come on naturally from that. But I think the signaling side is important to consider and just talk about how we cope with the contrast between the very high power signals that we're seeing through the system in the test bed and the very low requirements of the instrumentation and how we keep those apart.
Okay, makes sense. So just to elaborate on that, then, talking about the low power, what I call low power side, or the signal cabling side of electrical inside a test cell, that is even more comprehensive in regards to the amount of cabling and the routing that gets involved, of where they go to the various sensors, to the various devices. There's a lot of different pathways it takes as you're laying things out in a test cell. But one of the key things are to consider is the location in its relationship to the high power.
Right. I mean, just again, to scale that, we've now dropped down and we're talking about, what, 5 volts or 2 volt signals, you know,
right,
compared to the 400 or 800 volts we're talking about earlier. We're now talking about very small signals.
Right. And then from to elaborate on that in regards to the size-wise, cable size-wise, you're talking about something now that a single cable for high power that's the diameter of, I don't know what's the best way to say it, in dimensionally saying, you know, 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch in diameter cables to something of a 16 to 22 gauge wire, multi-stranded copper wire, or whatever the medium is that it's flowing through. So, but there's a lot of them. It is important that you understand how they get routed, the proper way to route it, one, in its relationship to high power, because that brings up other issues that we'll talk about further.
Right. So I guess when the instrumentation wires are running, they can run together. They're not critical on how they cross each other. It's when you start having the big cables getting involved, which starts to become complicated and how we keep the signals apart.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to dive too far into the minutiae with this one, but just to highlight a few points. Yes, to your comment about how you route in accordance with standard procedure, electrical procedure, how you route wires, high power, low power, signal cabling, but also what you do to the signal cabling to prevent noise from entering into that cable or being transmitted to the cable. And when I say that, I mean shielding of cables.
Right.
Physically shielding the cable from noise, which is common, that is common practice that you go through when you do the wiring or when you lay out the design and spec out the material.
So we talked a little bit about the layout of the wiring then. If we take the instrumentation, if we've got, I don't know, say 30 signal leads coming out of the test cell to the water control room, they can run together, but they've got to be presumably through some sort of shielded or some conduit to protect them both physically and electronically.
Yeah, it all depends on what the signal is. And there's different ways of shielding cable or isolating those cables from noise. And it all depends upon what you're using. There are some signals that are more sensitive, that are critical, that you don't want to see any noise. So if you're doing control of a dynamometer or controlling speed, you know, your load cells for measuring torque or your speed for picking up speed or your sensors you're using for measuring speed, you want to make sure those are clean, that you're not getting any interference. Because you can only imagine if you're trying to control something running at high speed and all of a sudden you get a erratic signal, which could cause problems. And you want to make sure that that signal is pure and there is no noise in the measurement string.
by noise or electronic interference.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
So a condition when that happened for me in the past was working on a big engine, a big dyno, was when we had a signal cable running across the floor of the test cell because of just the way the test cell had had to be changed for that particular application.
Mm-hmm.
And it ran near one of the high voltage leads. And we finished up there with a control issue where we're having interference affecting the dyno, and the actual dyno was beginning to operate on sort of random instructions rather than to any control, which was okay, but could have been really quite dangerous if that had allowed the dyno to run away.
Right, right. Noise in a test cell is one of the problem children, as I call it, when you design and you operate test cells, especially if you make changes to the test cell after it's been built already. Understanding this can become very problematic because it may not be something that happens or occurs all the time. It may be a sporadic problem or an intermittent problem, and that makes it even more challenging to find out what's going on and why something's not reading correctly or why something's not responding or controlling the way you anticipated it to.
Okay, well, you mentioned there about changes that have to be made after the event. So during the design phase, is there a way of future-proofing, if you like, a way of preparing a test cell so that it has enough signal capability for now and for the future? Do we just lay in a whole load of signal lines to prepare for that?
That's one way of doing it. You can never predict exactly what you're going to need when you're going to need it, although the one thing you can predict is you're probably going to need more than what you started. Right. So to at least make the conduit large enough to run additional cabling through would be step one. You not necessarily have to run three more bundles of cables, but that may be what you prefer to do because it's easier to do it when you pull the cables to begin with. But typically what will happen is you'll oversize the conduits to be able to future-proof to a certain extent.
Right.
Otherwise, you're running another conduit, and you may have to bust up concrete to run to get the conduit to go to point A to point B. The one thing that I did want to mention, though, that sometimes people don't take into consideration is you got to make sure right at the beginning that the power coming in is clean. And when I say clean, typically when you're doing signal measurement, you want to make sure you have what they call clean power. And that means you're filtering the power coming into the test cell. So there's a power supply or some form of power that is cleaned up.
More carefully regulated for voltage and current?
It's mainly regulated in regards to maintaining a certain voltage across the board, meaning that if you set it up for, say, 110 volts, you're controlling right at 110 volts. You don't have these series of ups and down in voltages that you would in a common household.
Which isn't important if it's running a radio or a TV, but becomes important if you're looking at little delicate signals.
Correct, because bit matters.
But does that cover every piece of electronics in the test cell? I mean, from power supply to the dyno right through to instrumentation, or is that more specific for the instrumentation and control side?
It's typically specific for the instrumentation side, but I've seen power filtering on a high level or a high power side as well. It just depends on the application.
Okay, so that's something you could... Difficult to predict at the beginning of what you might need, I suppose. But again,
right.
Over-designing is, in most cases, more protective than under-designing.
Right. And again, it's the risk in which you want to take. How much risk do you want to take? When I worked at a larger company like General Electric, we literally had made sure power was clean no matter where it was going inside the test cell, typically high and low. But more importantly, we even had huge battery backups because we didn't want to go down. We wanted all the critical equipment to stay operational. So we spent a lot of money on creating a large bank of batteries, basically, is what it ended up being, to keep things operational in case there was a power outage.
Yeah, I can see that's useful. It's becomes quite expensive to start adding that sort of capacity into a test cell for engine rebuild testing, for example. That gets to be more important for critical testing when you're running presumably larger engines or trying to maintain a longer durability.
Right. And one thing to keep in mind is again, we're bringing up some examples on the higher end side of things.
Yeah.
you may have a simple test cell that doesn't need all of that, or it's not, you know, its value isn't there to spend that amount of money based upon what you're trying to accomplish. You just need to consider that. Obviously, we can't predict or forecast what every single person is going to do for their test cells, but just give you some guidance and some general knowledge to say that you may not need all of this. We're just using various bits and pieces and examples of what we've seen, what we've dealt with in the past, the easier things that you can achieve or go down the path of and not spend a lot of money. So maybe we should spend a little bit of time and just talk about that, which segues into, I think, the other aspect of power is, we've talked about the noise aspect of it, but the grounding aspect of it.
Right.
So a lot of issues that I've seen in test cells and where we've had intermittent problems and noise-related issues solely had to do with proper grounding. And when I talk about proper grounding, it could be as simple as driving a copper rod, 3/4-inch copper rod, 8 feet into the ground and having an earth ground.
Right.
All the way through creating a grounding grid outside of the building with multiple ground rods and in a fully designed grounding system to ensure that we've eliminated any potentials of that form of noise that involves grounding.
That's a very extreme example, though, to have a grounding station like that.
Oh, yeah. It all depends on the circumstances. Now, what drove that is because we had a noise-related issue that we could not get to go away. It was a grounding issue that the single ground rod did not solve. So typically, what I would say is when you follow the rules of electricity and the proper ways of doing things with electrical wiring in the industry, you're going to ground it in some form or another. Typical way is you'll use a grounding rod, a single grounding rod, and that should suffice. But sometimes it won't. So I've used an extreme of...
Right. But just going, okay, so assuming we've got a good ground, there are then some guidelines about how to lay out the control wiring, the instrumentation wiring, relative to the higher voltage, the higher signal lines. I mean, one thing is to keep them apart, but also is how to, when you have to come through a narrow area, how do you run them when they've got to be either next to each other or crossing?
Okay, so the general rule of thumb, and I think this is, I'm not an electrical engineer, but I do know some of the rules, and one of them is if you have to, I mean absolutely have to, run a high voltage wire next to a low voltage wire, or you need to get from one point to another, cross at a 90-degree angle. If you have to do that, make sure you cross at a 90-degree angle. I can't explain the whys behind it. All I know is that's one of the rules.
Or similarly, I suppose, Richard, running them in separate conduits would also be a way of separating them and having a strong electrical barrier between them.
Yes, but again, if you were going to even run conduits, high power and low power, you'd run them 90 degrees.
Right, yeah.
You'd cross over 90 degrees.
Yeah, so some of that needs some quite early understanding of the layout of the test cell to actually create the opportunity to bring signals through from the dyno into the control room or the power source independently. You actually have to start laying those in right at the concrete stage to make space for separate conduits, separate areas.
And again, an example that maybe people can relate to is if you look at the modern day automobile, the amount of engineering that goes into grounding, shielding, wire routing, and all the noise that the electrical noise and the noise that you could see inside an automobile has to be considered and has been engineered year after year after year to make sure that's eliminated or prevented from happening. Because there's multiple processors on an automobile and they're susceptible to these types of things as well. This is something that we take for granted sometimes, the amount of engineering that goes into the modern day automobile.
All right, you're trying to think about some of that when laying out a test cell. Is there any areas or sort of extraneous electrical input that we need to be careful of? I mean, just in the control room, if somebody's using a special piece of equipment, I guess that could cause something to interfere with some existing equipment.
A real basic example is anything that's high power that's switching on and off.
Right.
That is a problematic area that you want to isolate because it could cause problems inside your test cell when you're trying to run. Case in point, one facility I worked at, they ran three shifts a day, and I was getting complaints on the second shift that they were having issues running with controllability. So the farther we dug into it, and again, this was a fabrication shop slash machine shop slash test cell.
Right.
What was happening is there was a welding station right next to the test cell, and every time they fired up the welder and started striking an arc,
wow,
that was causing problems. That just actually was induced.
Electromagnetic radiation from that spark was causing.
It was definitely affecting the signals. And we had to isolate the, again, it was another example of how we needed to look at isolating the, get the welder out of the picture, getting the welder out of the same circuit.
Right, yeah.
That the test cell used. So isolate the circuits.
So again, a good example of isolation of ensuring the test bed is as standalone as possible in terms of electrical supply and any signal conditioning.
Right, well, right.
That's very good. Yeah,
yep.
Good example.
So I think the other example that I thought was quite unique, I know that you mentioned one earlier, but I was at a customer site where they couldn't get the dynamometer control RPM as tight as it's the equipment our equipment's capable of doing. And we know it can do it. It's the way we designed it and we've proven it. But this test site could not get it to control. So as we went down there and we took a look at all the signal wiring and how it was running, we opened up the control box only to find out there was a couple things. One, the wires were not neatly routed. Two, some of the key signal wiring wasn't shielded. Three, there was high power in that same box. So all the things we talked about earlier is all the things that we found wrong, and it affected the control signaling because the what we were measuring for torque was sporadic. It wasn't solid. It wasn't consistent. And there was no reason why it shouldn't be. So
this was the interference from unshielded wiring and just picking up random signal.
Yeah, there were 110-volt switching circuits inside that same box. So they had mechanical contacts, electrical contacts were opening and closing that were causing changes in the signal.
Right. So what's the shielding which would typically be used? I mean, is this coaxial or is it more elaborate than
It's typically when you, and again, this is just my opinion that I've seen in the industry, is typically they have what they call a foil-wrapped shield that goes around the cable, but they also run a ground lead with that foil that touches that foil, so it does something with it. That ground lead attaches to a ground, then it completes the process of the circuit to properly ground it. So whether, you know, again, this is probably a topic for another future podcast just to talk about grounding because this could go on for a while.
It can be quite elaborate, can that requirement?
Sure, yeah, sure. Yeah. There's different ways of skinning the cat, as they said, but there's certain ways that you definitely need to do it certain ways per the standards. Otherwise, you're going
to
ask for
problems. Yeah, well, let's come on to that another time then, Mike. That's been an interesting introduction to the electrical side of things.
Yep. So I think the best case scenario is that we will pick a couple topics maybe for a future podcast to dive down into the detail, like grounding is one of them, signal wiring, which kind of go hand in hand. That way can give a little bit more insight and guidance to the listeners out there.
That'll be valuable.
No problem.
Thank you for listening to Dyno Insights presented by Frude. If there are any engine testing topics you'd like us to discuss, we'd love to hear from you. Please email us at podcast@frudedyno.com.